So for me, these kinds of ideas, like what helps me is, first of all, the use of language as a reflection. So like if I put in the word non-becoming, for me that's a significant word from the Four Noble Truths, non-becoming. And then that is like a mirror to maybe the way I'm striving, trying to get something. Non-desire. Availability, I find that an interesting word. If I'm dreaming and scheming, I'm not available. Planning, organizing, regretting, whatever, I'm not available. Well, when I drop all that and I just listen, that's availability. So you see how you can use language to remind you of a way of being which is in the present moment, which is aware, which is alert, which isn't caught up with past and future, rather than just kind of forcing yourself, I must be present, I must be present. So the kind of subtlety of use of language, I find that for myself very helpful. Also just, I find helpful making very conscious the sense of presence, rather than sort of like noticing thoughts, just trying to get rid of them, trying to focus on the breath, but really it's kind of not fully informed. But when I just say, this is the way it is now, then I'm really fully informed about this moment. Yeah? Just really present. So making that very conscious, then that becomes something that I tend to remember, tend to recollect, fully conscious. And then that, applying that to the breath or whatever object of meditation you take. So it's kind of, it's like really, again, if you think of craft, you know, like any work you do, if you get the foundation wrong, it's not going to work right. I mean, one of our monks, he's a really good cabinet maker, and if he got like two-thirds through a job, and he saw he had made a mistake, he'd take it right back to before the mistake. And I thought, well, I'd never do that. And he had beautiful workmanship. Yeah. So kind of getting the basics right is actually very profound. It's kind of really understanding what awareness is, understanding how to make effort without desire, without aversion, these kinds of things. So I would suggest, you develop language that helps you in that way. This is the language I find helpful, but whatever language you find helpful to bring consciousness to the state of presence and non-desire. And then what I find very useful, learning to abide with the heart rather than the head. So if I'm relating to people and I'm abiding more from the heart chakra, I tend to understand them better. I tend to communicate with them better. If I'm abiding from thought, sometimes it can be critical or whatever, and I find the heart is very well informed. So I find just that useful to activate, make conscious this part of one's being. And sometimes because we live in a culture which is very intellectual, and for Westerners, especially the devotional parts of the practice they don't come to us easily, I think. Just to consciously feel the heart center, make it known. When I started this, I used to rub tiger balm on my chest. Let's get something going here, right? Now it's a bit better. because we're not just intellectual beings. We understand life in all manner of ways, don't we? Not just from thought. Right thought is important. Nothing wrong with it. But to make conscious other parts of your being as a way of understanding both yourself, and it's a way of abiding, just having a place of abiding. You'll find most teachers, I think, they'll talk about a certain place of abiding. Ajahn Sumedho will talk about the sound of silence, if you've read his work. I think Ajahn Dhan talked about Asubha meditation. That's where he abided. Huh? And there's something about each meditator, just through, I guess, character and preference and so on, they just find something where their attention can easily abide with. They feel kind of relaxed with it or peaceful with it. So that's something that is very individual. So if a teacher is teaching something which you can't really abide with, or abide by, and you can't really just rest with, then don't think you're wrong. It's just that that is not your place of abiding. But the principles of letting the mind rest on something, with something, in a peaceful way, that's universal, I think. That's universal. So that leads to this one question here. Fortunately, no one asked for a lottery number, so grateful for that. They do in Thailand. when I was at Dhammaram, there was a gentleman there who's an interesting guy. He's an ex-con, and he did some pretty nasty things. He's kind of come around. He gives a great foot massage. He's like, his hands are like this big. So all the time he's massaging me, trying to get a lottery number out of me. In Thailand, they think monks have powers, and so they think like an old guy like me somehow has insight into lottery numbers, which is not true. But it would be very profitable, wouldn't it? Anyway, when I meditate on the breath, as the breath becomes finer, the sound of silence becomes louder. Should I keep the awareness on both the breath and the sound of silence, or only on either one of them? So for those of you who have read Ajahn Sumedho or who practice it, when your mind becomes very refined, or not even so, just when your mind sort of rests in non-grasping, you often notice the sound of a kind of ringing sound in the background of consciousness. It's almost electronic, it's hard to describe, but it's a sign that Ajahn Sumedho teaches a lot. You find it in many of his talks. It's a sign of the mind resting and non-grasping. And that comes up when your mind is usually very quiet and with the object of meditation. And so he's cultivated that as a kind of rather unique, actually, in Theravada tradition, a unique way of abiding in, say, the empty mind. And his own experience of that was he noticed it in his first year of meditation, if I have the story correctly. And then when we were in Hampstead in London, he was walking along Haverstock Hill, which is a super busy street, and bam, the sound of silence came up into his consciousness. And from there he decided to try to actually cultivate that as a way of abiding in non-grasping. And he did that for quite a few years before he actually taught it, and now he teaches it a lot. So for those who, you know, kind of sense that, what he tend to recommend is to learn how to be with that sound by even counting, say, count to 15 with that sound as a background. So if you do notice that, it's an interesting one to kind of experiment with. But note it, if it doesn't come up, don't make it a problem. If it does come up, don't think you've got anything. So people kind of hear, oh, I've got it. And then you're done. So if it's there, it's there. If it's not, it's not. But if you do notice it, what we're really interested in is the mind of clarity, the mind of presence, the mind which is not grasping. That's the most important thing. So if you notice that, you can try to just listen to it. It's always there. Just listen to it, and it's kind of the same as just in the kind of receptive listening. It indicates a mind which is present and not caught up with things. So with this question, should I keep the awareness on both the breath and the sound of silence, or only one or either of them? Well, first of all, that's doubt, right? And you have to make sure that you also recognize doubt. And so doubt comes up. Should I or shouldn't I? Right? And usually it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter so much. It's just not to get caught in the doubt. The most important thing is the quality of awareness which knows objects coming and going, and the object in this case is a mental object, is doubt. And I think we can all see when the mental, like a mood of doubt comes up, if we grasp it, then we start thinking a lot. Should I? And sometimes we have to. You know, there's nothing wrong with doubt. Maybe you smell smoke, you say, uh-oh, what's that? So you don't want to go back to your meditation, you want to go outside to the fire hose, right? So there's nothing wrong with doubt, but in the meditative practice, we're seeing doubt as just an object of mind. And then you can make a choice. So with this person, I would say do one, do the other, or do both. It doesn't really matter so much, but the most important thing is actually just to experiment. So if you have a doubt like that, then quite deliberately try something. Just try one for a while, for a week. Try the other for a week. See how it goes. See how it works. But you do want to have a way of meditation which is quite consistent. That's very helpful. You know, some like an object of meditation which you can easily remember, go back to, and just it kind of reminds you of silence. It leads you into silence because you're so familiar. It's like a friend. Like a friend you go back to. So with Lompo, he uses the sound of silence and he quite encourages it that way. With the breath, you mean if I'm doing breath work, I hear that sound too. I mean, it's just natural. And what do I don't really choose either. I recollect more the quality of awareness. That's what's important for me, quality of awareness, which kind of leads to the next question. I feel the basis of my meditation is that one can't watch the breath or become peaceful with will. So I try to just create the conditions, metta, for peace, or the breath, mindfulness, to arise naturally. This has been fruitful, but sometimes I seem too scattered. There's no anchor. Is it a case of finding right effort, guiding towards an object but remaining soft? Question. That's quite a good question because will, you can see how much like will is sense of self, isn't it? I'm going to get something. I'm going to do something. And yet effort has to involve intention. If I don't make any intention, if I don't focus the mind, then my mind tends to waffle a lot. So I think what happens, it's a kind of progressive thing where we, like when we begin meditation, at least this was the case for me, I was very willful and I was unsuccessful. And from that lack of success, I then just tried to do nothing. And again, I was unsuccessful. Two strikes and you're out. So then I began to see, well, I have to put some kind of effort forth, but it can't be this fierce effort which I was making. So I kind of moderated my use of will. And then if it was too tense, I would kind of let go, and then I'd let go too much. So I began to just watch the very use of will and the very nature of effort. So part of the meditation project, as it were, is understanding how to make effort, how to use intention, and how not to be blindly willful. Because if you're blindly willful, you'll just be tense all the time, as the person's saying. So when I use language like receptive, and just be receptive to this moment. Now that's an intention, but it's not a willful attempt to try to get something. Right? It's a kind of quality of consciousness, which for me works, that word. But for other people, that word is too vague. And they need something, you know, hold on, or whatever word they use. So usually the effort becomes more and more refined as you go. So when you begin a meditation, you might have to remind yourself, breath. And then as your mind, and I spoke about this the other day, as your mind begins to hold or be with the object, there's less need for effort. You don't need to say these things. And then maybe you kind of get lost and you need to kind of reinforce it. So it's not a fixed thing, but I think that like the person's intuition that you can't just willfully make the mind peaceful. That's very true. If it was that easy, everyone would be enlightened. You know, just sit down and willfully for 8 hours, I'm going to be enlightened, which most monks try, I think, and fail. So, you know, it doesn't take a Buddha to do that. It's got to be more subtle than that. And that subtlety is something that is a part of the craft, just by trying and being really conscious of how you make effort and what the result of that kind of effort is, rather than think you're doing it wrong. You know, kind of this, just really try really hard, be more spacious. So some meditations, like some people that I know well, some people just they don't like breath meditation at all. And they've been meditating for 20, 30 years because they get too willful. And so they tend to find the more like shikantaza, the choiceless awareness practices, or space. Like they'll contemplate space. They'll find that really relaxes their mind. So like if you contemplate in this room, you have objects, right? You have people, shrine, sound, color. Now to notice the space in the room, what do you need to do? Well, you need to take your attention away from objects and somehow relax the mind and then there's space. Now that's quite subtle. But some people really find that much more calming than an object like the breath. But some people get utterly spaced out. They just go, all over the planet. But if you do that, like you just like to notice the space, you have to take your attention away from objects and your mind relaxes. But then if your mind starts to not understand that and you waffle on and so on, then it doesn't work. So one person I can think of in Toronto, she really just, the breath just doesn't work for her because it's just too much kind of sense of control and willfulness that comes up. So she uses space or choiceless awareness. Other people, you suggest that choiceless awareness, they just get lost in thinking, and they find a more focused approach is much more helpful. And that's the kind of experiment that you try to do. And so this question is very good in that way, is that the way we use will, the way we use intention is very important to understand. And it's very personal that way. So you mentioned, Ajahn, you mentioned the value of beauty. It sometimes seems there's an ambivalence in some spiritual traditions towards material beauty. Could you say something about the value of beauty in the practice? Well, if the way I look at it, if beauty points to itself, and see if you understand this. If beauty points to itself, then it's idolatry. But if beauty points back to awareness, then it's spirituality. In other words, if you like, of those Buddha Rupas, aesthetically, I like the little white guy. Huh? Aesthetically. So then, if I look at it aesthetically, I see, where can I get one? So, beauty is pointing to itself. And hence, I don't really want it, honest, don't give it to me. That's what monks do. They say, hey, I heard that.
Maybe guess not someone to box it up first.
But if you see what I'm pointing to. So aesthetically, or these beautiful, I mean, look at the shape of these two vases. I mean, they're, and the color, right? So aesthetically, if the beauty is pointing to itself, then I'm already packing it. And going to Amazon and figuring out how I can get one home. So beauty, which points to itself, creates the desire to ownership, right? But if the beauty strikes me in such a way that it steals my mind into a sense of awe, then it's pointing back to the subject, to the awareness. And that's what we call spiritual art, art which brings you back. So in like Buddhist iconography, it's not the aesthetics, it's the reminder that the Buddha is the awakened. So when you look at a Buddha image, if you just look at it and hold your attention in looking, like you can hold listening, then that brings you to stillness. But if you look at it, beauty as aesthetics, and you think, wow, what's with the big chest anyway? And what happened to his head? And so the mind becomes critical or whatever. It takes on a different, just what I mean. Now, like with people, you know, if a man sees a beautiful woman, it's a very hard for the man not then to try to do something to own that beauty, right? So with people, it's very, very hard. Something's very, very attractive. Then, like, biologically, we're drawn to people because of beauty. And yet, when we see someone like the Dalai Lama, like his beauty, to me, it just brings me back to compassion. It's not like I want to own the Dalai Lama, right? Or have a date with him. Oops, that's recorded. Now I'm in trouble. You see what I mean? So, but beauty has a particular, like when you, I think that's why natural beauty can be so, that word awe, I don't know, in Australia, do young people use the word like it's awesome for fish and chips? It's a totally ruined word, isn't it?
They say sick.
Huh?
They say sick.
Oh, they say sick now, that's better. We get awesome back into the language. But you know, that word awe, which used to be quite a beautiful word, your mind's in awe, can't use it anymore, so kind of jaded. But when I just saw the big kauri trees in New Zealand, the circumference of the biggest was 17 meters circumference, massive tree. As soon as you see it, you're, this can't be true. The mind just stops. The mind stops. And it's that stopping of the mind that we're interested in the spiritual life, where the mind isn't always just trying to go somewhere else. It's in the moment, it stopped, awakened. Huh? So beauty is a very, very interesting kind of thing to contemplate. I found with my mother, if I could introduce beauty, especially in her garden, or whatever, if I could introduce beauty, it was so helpful to her because her sense experience was so negative. Macular degeneration, osteoporosis, you know, the whole lot of negative sense experience. And I could see that if somehow I could bring in color or sound, which was beautiful, it was very uplifting. And it was very, very helpful for her to change the mind. Which is interesting for me because as a monk, you know, we're not into Vivaldi, as you might have noticed by our chanting. And so that kind of stimulation through color and so on, you don't find much in the monastery. I mean, I think we all appreciate aesthetics and so on. But I could see that with my mother, that if I could bring in beauty, it was really helpful for her. So she'd be in the garden. We had this, she had a largish terrace on the fourth floor, and we had lots of potted flowers. And she would go out for half an hour and just look and be delighted. And she said that would, the memories of that color would carry her for 2 or 3 hours in beauty. Now it's a very interesting insight for me to see how, because her sight was so poor, the contrast was actually very helpful for her, very uplifting. Okay? Brought her to a state of happiness. So, In Theravada, we do say that we have some pretty strong words. We have words like revulsion, or abandonment, which are very strong words. And some of the language of liberation is that the mind becomes so repelled by sense consciousness that it turns away and chooses Nibbana as its object. Now that's a very high state of meditative attainment, where the whole sense experience is just seen to be, it's just growth, and the mind turns to nibbana. But if that's taken too in a shallow way, then you can kind of get into sort of a hair shirt religion, and like, it's awful, the world is awful, it's a terrible place, and it's ugly, and which is just a kind of negative viewpoint of the world. But that's not really, the world is as it is. So one has to be careful of that. We have a whole series of meditations called Asubha, which Asubha is the unbeautiful. And why would you bring up the unbeautiful? Well, because of the fascination with the beautiful. So Asubha is like, let's say, if you want to buy a BMW, right? I'm sure you all do. And Asubha would be to consider how this is going to impact your pocketbook and how much it's going to cost you, and you've already got two cars. It would be looking at the negative side of some kind of delightful thing that you want to own. And typically in Theravada Buddhism, Asubha is seen like corpse meditations, body meditations, and so on, which can lead to dispassion. But I know monks who have a lot of aversion in their mind. They love to do that. And I think maybe you should do more metta. So they kind of, there was one monk, I remember, he was quite ghoulish actually, and he loved to just get into these Asubha meditations, and he's such a depressed guy. I said, yeah, what about metta? How about lifting the heart? Whereas another monk might be so, you know, he's kind of infatuated with life, he might need a Asubha meditation. Life is wonderful. Look at a corpse. So you have these different meditations. Venerable Kantipalo wrote a book called Bag of Bones. You know, if you ever saw his little wheel publication, boy, that's heavy. It's like every Asubha meditation you can think of. But I know for myself, I went, when I was a young monk, I would go to autopsies in Bangkok. I haven't done that in Canada because they'll think I'm a ghoul. But we used to go, when we were like doing visas in Bangkok, we'd go to Siraj Hospital and the doctors would let us watch an autopsy. And that was very powerful, very, very powerful, just to see. Like there was a monk had died, and they were doing autopsy on him, and they didn't have any heavy, they had like a hacksaw. They cut his head, they cut the skin here, and they pulled his face off. Ooh. Hey, who is this guy? And then they cut his head, he just had this like hacksaw. Nothing fancy, and they're holding his head. And they flipped up the top of the skull and took his brain out, had a look at his brain. And so I asked the doctor, so what did he die of? The doctor looked at me and said, too much thinking. But what it did, it was interesting what it did for my mind. It's like I was, it's quite a young monk. When I went out into the marketplace afterwards, like, because I had to go to the market to get to the bus I was taking, whatever, my mind was very dispassionate. It was very cool, you know, and because the market's so kind of, whoa, look at this, look at that, and, but the mind was very cooled. So we have a lot of meditations around things which cool the mind, cool the passions, right? And they get a lot more emphasized than beauty. But beauty, I think, would be what we call the mind which opens to beauty in a non-possessive way, I think. I would think is the quality of mudita, which is the third of the heart qualities. We have metta, which is goodwill, karuna, which is compassion, mudita, which is joy, appreciative joy, and upekkha, which is equanimity. And mudita is like, notice what, when your mind is relaxed, when you're not overly concerned about yourself, you can look at a flower and really see it, can't you? You know, or the shape of a spider web, or the smell of the eucalyptus, in a way which is very present and very beautiful. So What is that about the mind, when the mind is not self-consumed, that it can appreciate life in a rather beautiful way? Is that wrong? I don't think so. I think it's a quality of the heart which is very open. But if I grasp that beauty, and I want the world to always be that way, then I get possessive, I want to own it, and then if I don't have it... And so the attachment to aesthetics, aesthetes suffer a lot. Aesthetes are like the biggest sufferers in the world because they can't take it if there's an extra carnation in the array, right? It's just sort of, we had a very famous architect lived next to us at Chidhurst, and we were replanting we were doing a really good job on the forest replanting trees. We had botanists and everything, and he had a beautiful house he had done up next to our land, and he was getting uptight about the type of trees we were planting. I said, give me a break, man, it's just a tree. But his sense of aesthetics was so refined that there's no way he could be happy. You know, he kind of tortured himself with this kind of aesthetics. So that's when beauty goes really off, when we're so attached to aesthetics that we can't live with the ugly in life or live with the non-beautiful. All right? I think I've covered it.